All right, thank you, Cliff. Am I on? Everyone can hear me? Okay, good. I'm going to ask again, how many of you are experimenters? Because we lost two, and I wanted to see what the half-life was. So, okay, so this time there's three in the room, so that's better than two. More to the point, how many of you who are theorists self-identify as phenomenologists? Formal theory? Interesting. Okay.
No one ever self-identifies as a formal theorist.
All right. I've been lecturing for longer than most of you have been alive. I've learned my faults. One of them is I talk way, way, way too fast. Left to my own devices, I will go through all four lectures by lunchtime. So I'm counting on you to slow me down and raise your hand and say, wait, wait, wait a second. What you said makes no sense. Or even you said it too fast for me to understand. So my goal is not to cover as much material as possible. It's to uncover as much material as possible. I'm happy if we go through one slide and you understand it. All right, here's the syllabus. I'm going to do this backwards. One of the reasons I decided to do this backwards is normally what you do in this is people start from the very beginning and build up to something that's interesting. And as I'm building up, you'll have no earthly idea why. So instead what I'm going to try and do, and this is a bit of an experiment, so it may fail, but they're never going to ask me back here again, so it doesn't matter. I'm going to start by walking you through the Higgs discovery, a standard Higgs discovery talk. Maybe point out a little stuff to keep aware of. Then we're going to go back and do it again, looking piece by piece why people made certain decisions that they did. This is really more of a why talk than a what talk. Does anyone here not believe that the Higgs was discovered? All right. Hence the reason to go into the why rather than the what. So I'll discuss colliders and detectors. I'm going to talk a little bit about electron colliders, not nearly as much as I should. I've got about 70 minutes on what did we learn from the LHC to try and put this into some context rather than the death march of plots, and then talk a little bit about future colliders. So anyone object to this plan? Good. I also want to thank the organizers. This is an opportunity to come. I like doing summer schools. I've never done a tricep before. My family comes from Quebec, not the part down here where reasonable people live, but the part way up there, which caused people to want to leave.
Which town?
North of Quebec City. So.
Saint-Jean, or do you remember the name?
I do not know the name. I do know that there's a warrant out for the arrest of my great grandparents. That's all.
Do you know what for?
Yes, but things are running. All right, so who am I? Why did they pick me? I got my PhD in 92 on Fermilab E705, which was a fixed target charmonium experiment, and I then moved into colliders, and I've worked at pretty much every hadron collider since. I've worked at the Tevatron at CDF, I've worked at STAR at RIC, ATLAS at the LHC. Not so recently, I was the physics coordinator of ATLAS, and before that, I was the physics coordinator of STAR. That's a picture of a small, round-faced, adorable creature holding a koala. And I've done both Standard Model and BSM physics, and my interests basically lie on the border between them. Can we measure known processes well enough that we could see an excess over them? So that's who I am, and that's what I do. Even by slide six, I'm cheating. I'm going to talk about colliders, and I'll use the Higgs discovery as sort of a framework. And I promise to do this, so I will, but I'm not going to send you through what I call the death march of jungles of plots and tables. I'm going to try to explain more what we know and how we know it, what we'd like to know, what we didn't know, how you might go about doing this, and I'm going to give examples from the collider experiments. And, you know, as Francis apologized to his absent collaborators, I will apologize to my absent collaborators. I'm not going to be able to cover everything with only four lectures. So even though there are three plus or minus one experimenters here, I assume most of you have gone to experimental seminars of some sort. You understand what I mean by the death march of jungles and tables? Okay, we're not going to do that. We'll start with spontaneous symmetry breaking, and this is a very different view than what Veronica gave. It's exactly the same science, but we're going to come at it from another direction. So I have four cities. We'll call them, where's my hockey stick? We will call them Vancouver, Whitehorse, Yellowknife, and Winnipeg. And they happen to be on the corners of a square, believe it or not. What's the least...
There's no railroad between those cities.
And I'd like to build them. What's the least amount of track that I need? All right, who here thinks four units? Come on, somebody raise your hand. Obviously. But of course, I can also do it with three, right? Because I can get from here to here by going all the way around. So, any guesses what's the absolute minimum I need?
Two root two.
Two root two is a very good answer. But it's wrong. This is the actual solution. It's 1 plus root 3. All right? And notice that the symmetry of the solution is lower than the symmetry of the problem. So this had a four-fold symmetry problem, but the solution has only a two-fold symmetry. You might be thinking, oh my God, this is terrible. But actually, there are two solutions, this one and that one. And the sum of the solutions, the degeneracy of the solutions, has the full symmetry, even though each individual one doesn't. This is spontaneous symmetry breaking. That's all there is to it. Now, you probably could have guessed this, because if you've ever looked at soap bubbles, which are trying to minimize the amount of surface they have, same basic problem, they form a 120-degree angle. So it's the same problem again. But that's not important. Another example, which is a little bit closer to the Higgs, is ferromagnetism. The Hamiltonian has full 3D symmetry, but an actual bar magnet that you buy in the store has only cylindrical symmetry. So you asked, how is this possible? Right? And the answer is, I can orient one of these in any direction I want. So even though any individual solution has only the cylindrical symmetry, all of the possible solutions have the full symmetry of the problem. In general, you will see situations where you have low symmetry at low temperature and higher symmetry at high temperature. So if I take a ferromagnet and bring it past the Curie temperature, it loses its ferromagnetism. Yes? No? All right, so now let's talk about the Higgs mechanism. I can write down a theory of massless weak bosons, and it's nothing whatsoever wrong with it, except for one little tiny thing. It doesn't describe the world we live in. But as a theory, it's fine. It's renormalizable, it's gauge invariant, it's everything. I'm going to add a new doublet of spin zero particles. And by doublet, I mean 4 degrees of freedom. It's just how we do it. Now, I write down the interactions between the new doublet itself and the new doublet and the weak bosons in just the right way to do two things. Spontaneously break the symmetry. This is the sign of lambda that you saw yesterday. And the Higgs field then develops a non-zero vacuum excitation value, just like the magnetization in a ferromagnet. And then it also allows something really cute to happen. The really cute thing is that the massless weak bosons that I wrote down mix with the fields I just added, and you have one particle with three spin states. Massless particles have only two spin states. Massive particles have 2J plus 1. So the W, having picked up this extra component, has picked up a third spin state, so it's picked up a mass. The same thing happens with the W minus. In the neutral case, the same thing happens for exactly one neutral combination, and that becomes the Z. The other neutral combination stays as it was, the photon. This is the real beauty of the Higgs mechanism. It's not that the symmetry is broken, it's that it leaves the photon unchanged. Breaking the symmetry is easy. Leaving the photon massless is the trick. The other neutral combination is the photon, and you have 1 degree of freedom left. And because of the non-zero vacuum excitation value of the Higgs, you have a massive Higgs. So that's the thing we're going to look like. Now, how cute is it? That's my nephew. He can't help being this cute. It's genetic.
Take a picture of him with a koala.
So there's really very little choice involved when you write down this theory. There's one free parameter, which gives you the Higgs boson mass. There's one sign, which determines if the symmetry breaks or not. And it leaves the standard model pretty much untouched. It adds a new Higgs boson, which we can look for. It adds a new piece to the WW cross-section. That cross-section blows up at infinite energy. Not a good feature. You'd like to have our probabilities, somewhere between 0 and 1. This interferes destructively with that piece and keeps the cross-section finite. And in fact, the VEV of the Higgs is the Fermi constant here. So, onto the discovery. That was the seminar at CERN. You might be looking for me in the audience. I wasn't there. I was actually in the room with the press. They had a set of physicists who were kind of milling around, and I discovered a couple of interesting things. One is my job was to tell them the difference between million and billion. The other is the Associated Press, which is a wire service, has the most evil thing I've ever seen. It was like Google Docs on steroids. As he was writing his article, his editor was changing it out from under him.
I was there. I was in the corner, actually.
All right, so we're going to talk about how the Higgs is produced. Gluon-gluon fusion, where you have a top quark Luke here, dominates. Vector boson fusion is a 10% effect, and all of these are smaller than that. And before we even started the experiment, everybody knew how much the Higgs cross-section would be for any given mass. All right. The decays also, people knew. This actually makes perfect sense, all of these squiggles. At very high mass, it can decay. The Higgs can decay to Ws and Zs, and it loves to do that. Why? Because the Higgs is the W and the Z. That third component is from the same field. So since it's the same particle, it really, really wants to do that. As you back off in energy, right, it has to do other things, right? And it decays to basically the heaviest thing that it can, right?
Why is the gluon then better than the charm for a good section since they're massless?
Because the gluon is massless, but the Higgs doesn't couple directly to the gluons. It couples to the fermions. And I've got fermions in loops.
Ah.
So the top quarks in loops are driving that coupling, right? This is the same decay as the production channel. The gluons fuse to the top loop and give me a Higgs. The Higgs can decay to gluons through the same top loop and give me gluons. So modes like gamma gamma and z gamma are at one loop and they're suppressed by a factor of about 1,000. The 1 over 16 pi squared part I can do, the rest of it are up to the theorists. More on the Higgs decays. This is a pie chart I put up because people don't like using it. I was pretty much the first person to start using pie charts here because I just felt pie charts needed to be used more. And this sort of tells you what the Higgs do. It loves decaying to bottoms. It'll do WW and Z star. This is for 125. And then all this other stuff is down here. And two photons, which look beautiful on the log plot, is this tiny little sliver here. So the first lesson is never use a log plot. They're horribly, horribly misleading. Unless you want to mislead, in which case, always use a log plot. And the other is, why in the world would anybody design an analysis around this little tiny sliver? Doesn't it make more sense to go after the big slices? So I have to digress a little bit and talk about the inventor of the cut. There was a time before there were cuts. And it was invented by this man, a guy named Thales of Miletus. He was before Socrates, so he was therefore long before Aristotle. He was before Euclid. He was the first person to predict a solar eclipse. He was an early speculator in commodities. Aristotle said, this guy thought there'd be a great season on olives, so he bought a bunch of olive presses that he could then rent out at high rates and sell them back when there's going to be what he thought there'd be a terrible year. So he was an early speculator in that.
How did he do?
Quite well. So in some ways, he's the first quant. Anyway, he measured the height of the pyramids. And he didn't have Euclidean geometry because that would be centuries in the future. But what he realized was that twice a day, an object's shadow is the same height as the object itself. So the way he set it up was he had a stick in the stand and a piece of string the size of the stick watching the shadow and his graduate student running around the pyramid until he said, okay, stop. And then they went out and measured all of that. So what he realized is that out of the 86,400 seconds in the day, there are two of them where this measurement is easy. So that's where cuts came from. So let's look at those Higgs decays again. This is imagining you have this pie chart. Bottom quarks looked great, right? They have 60% branching fraction, good. About half of that's usable, right? The other, roughly 70% of the time you have a bottom quark, you can identify it, and I'll talk about that later. So 30% is a pretty big branching fraction. You can see all of it on here. But the background is roughly 50,000 to 1. So most of your bottom quarks are produced through gluons and the strong interaction. You've got as many of those as you want. And then there's this little tiny sliver of weakly produced Higgsy decays. You'll never find it in this background. WW star, the star means it's off shell. You end up at about 2%. That's few to one. That looks like you might be able to do something with that. ZZ star, signal background is roughly 1 to 1. Gluons, 10%. Now, that's not so bad, but now your background is millions to one. So it's a really lousy way to do a search. Taus are a long story, which, depending on how much time I have, I may or may not tell. Charm quarks are a factor of 10 down from the bottom, but they've got the same problem with signal to background. So there's no point in doing these if you can't do those. 2 photons is 0.2% branching fraction, but virtually every one of those is usable. And the signal to background is, say, 1 to 5. So the reason people are running their analysis around this tiny, tiny sliver of branching fraction is because the light is better here. So when you design an analysis, the amount of signal that you have is important. If you don't have any signal, you're not going to have any signal. Yes?
WW star looks like it's better on every possible metric, though. You've got 2% as opposed to 0.2% for your useful fraction and for your useful branching, and you've got also a few to one. Why did people not do that?
People did do that. I'm not going to talk about that in the detail because the 2 photons have one advantage. The Higgs decays to 2 visible particles, right? 1 photon and then the other. So when I reconstruct the invariant mass, I get a nice sharp peak because I've reconstructed the entire event. WW is decaying to a lepton plus a neutrino, so I have 2 missing neutrinos in the event that I have to infer how much they carried away. And that inference takes me from a nice sharp peak to a really ugly edge. So, but people do that. Anyway, getting a good signal to background is important, and I'm only going to touch on it tomorrow. Triggerability is important too, right? This is a very hard measurement to do because of the millions to one. If I have to write out events in 99.99999% of them I will never use, that's a problem. All right, so before we did the search, this is what we knew. Indirect electroweak fits told us the Higgs was somewhere in this ballpark. Direct searches excluded that ballpark. So people were kind of looking around this edge, right? Now, there's an assumption in this plot and that the only things that contribute to this were things that we knew about. So if there were new particles like supersymmetric ones, they will move this around. Now, my conclusion, and that was not universally held, but nevertheless, that doesn't make it wrong, is that Higgs could really be anywhere between the experimental limits and 1 TeV, which is the theoretical limit. If the Higgs weighs more than 1 TeV, it's not Higgsy enough to actually break the symmetry in the right way. So I figured that's really the bounds. Yes, this might say you've got better chance at the low energy, but you want to cover the whole range, which we'll talk about now, channel by channel. So LEP excluded this. The Tevatron at Fermilab was able to exclude this little window here. So that left a low mass window and a high mass window, and lots of predictions. These are how much data you would need to see something.
Why is the Tevatron exclusion? Why does the Tevatron exclusion not cover everything?
Because the Tevatron was able to do the exclusion in the WW channel, right? And one of the reasons they're able to do this is a W is heavy, and I'll talk about how heavy is heavy a little bit later, but they're really, really hard to make at the Tevatron. They're much easier to make at the LHC. So the background at the LHC is much higher. So anyway, gamma-gamma covers down here, and since I already know the answer, I'm going to concentrate on that. WW covers this region with, mercifully, some overlap. ZZ star covers out to here. And finally, ZZ, where you have two of them decaying into neutrinos, starts around 200, 250, and works its way out there. So depending on where the Higgs is, the best channel to search for it is different. So where are we after step zero? We're going to look at Higgs to gamma-gamma, because that's the low-mass one. And for 6 years, we've known this is the right answer. So with 20/20 hindsight, I will just start from there. This is produced 90% through glu-glu fusion and about 10% through vector boson fusion. Tiny, tiny branching fraction, 0.2%, but reasonable signal to background. Other people will look at WW star. Still other people will look at ZZ star. Other people will look for specialized decays, heavy Higgs, charged Higgs, supersymmetric Higgs. But this is a critical part of the analysis that often is not discussed when you hear the standard talk. Right. You have to think about what you're doing, why you're doing it, what the strategy is, what are the advantages and the disadvantages of the way you've shown. This often is just mistakenly called theory, but it's really more, I would say, part of being an experimenter is to think, what is it that I'm really trying to measure? All right, if we want to look for Higgs to two photons, we have to be able to identify photons. We need to separate this. That's a photon, and that's a photon. From this, which are two jets. Jets are blasts of particles that are all in the same direction. They come about from QCD, right? What happens if I take a magnet and I try and pull the North Pole away from the South Pole? Do I have to get the second grade teachers from down there?
Are you stretching out your magnet or are you just making it longer?
I'm pulling as hard as I can till the point where the steel breaks. What happens to the magnet? I make two magnets. Same thing if I take a quark and try to pull it out of a hadron. It stretches and stretches and stretches and eventually pops a quark anti-quark pair out of the vacuum. Right? That's confinement. So if I kick a quark or a gluon in a particular direction, what it will happen is it will dress itself in various hadrons and form a jet. And the key about the jet is that the momentum carried by the quark or the gluon is now carried by all of the particles that you can see. So what really matters more than what the individual particles are doing is what the ensemble does, because the jet is more directly connected to the quark or the gluon that produced it than this pion or that kaon or that proton. People usually have questions at this point. Okay. This is how you design a calorimeter. These are the very same showers Francis was talking about on Monday, right? So what happens is a photon comes in, hits a piece of material, converts to an electron-positron pair. They Bremsstrahlung photons, which convert to pairs of electrons and positrons, which Bremsstrahlung photons, and so on and so forth. This is an actual mathematical model here.
What's the zigzaggy background?
The zigzaggy background is the ATLAS calorimeter. So ATLAS has decided that what they want to do, we'll talk about calorimeter design tomorrow, but the basic issue is that in between these lead zigzags is liquid argon. The liquid argon does the actual energy measurements, and the lead is there to give you a lot of material. So Francis was talking about air showers in the atmosphere, which were kilometers long. What do you think their length should be in a detector?
Proportional to the density difference between the two?
Good guess. What's the density of air compared to water or steel or something? 1,000, right? So if he's talking about something which are kilometers long, these will be meters long, right? And since this pointed out, you want to get to the densities. If I put lead in there as opposed to just the argon, it gets shorter and shorter and shorter. So you can make something that's buildable. All right, so what do you want to look at to make sure this is a photon and not a jet? Well, you don't want to have too much energy here, because that means that you probably had a bunch of particles coming in there, not very isolated, probably not a photon. You want exactly one photon, not zero, because that's likely to be a hadron, or two, which is likely to be a pi zero, also a hadron. So you've got a bit of the Goldilocks principle there. You don't want it too big, you don't want it too little, you want it just right. You don't want it too wide here, because again, you want one photon and not two. So if there were two photons near each other, we'll be out here. And you don't want too much energy here, because that's indicative of a hadronic shower. That's an indication that you didn't interact up here when you were supposed to, but started interacting down here like a hadron. So this is how we decide it's a photon and not something else. EM showers all look the same. They are worldwide exactly like each other. Hadronic showers are like snowflakes. Every one of them is unique. Right? And one of the problems with that is some of these look like those. So this is the electromagnetic calorimeter out of ATLAS. Right, this is the whole ATLAS detector. It's 5 stories tall. Those are people there. If you came in closer, you'd see they're all wearing safety hats. This piece, which is about the size of a small house, is the calorimeter here. And as we mentioned before, uses lead as an absorber and liquid argon to measure ionization. The energy in the ionization gets converted to electrical signal. We like electrical signals. Yes?
What's the bright red square in the middle?
The bright red square in the middle. A very unfortunate person. I believe that is the innermost layer of our tracking system, but I will show you what the inside looks like more later. The resolution you get goes as 1 over the square root of E. I'll cover that tomorrow. And in this case, it's about 10% over the square root of E. So if I have 100 GeV, square root of 100 is 10, 10 over 10. So that tells me it's about a percent resolution plus the rest of these terms. So it does a very good job. If you look at it more closely, it's very highly segmented. So we see how the shower develops laterally and in depth. So we have a 3D picture of what's going on at the energy deposit. It has very good energy resolution, 10% over square root of E. It's not as good as CMS, which I'll cover in a second. And it goes to this accordion, like here, to put the electrodes as close together as you could to make this device as fast as it can be. So it takes many crossings, roughly 600 nanoseconds. So what's 600 divided by 25? 24? Is that right? Is this recorded? Okay, so something like 20, 2 dozen, that sounds even better. Interactions are actually recorded by this device every time you read it out because it's not fast enough to separate out. So you'd like to move that number as small as you can get it, right? And 600 is good, but it's not as good as 150, but it's better than 1200 and so on. This is what it looks like in real life. You can't see it anymore. It's now sitting in the middle of a cryostat because argon is a gas at room temperature. You have to get this to roughly minus 100. And it's now in a cryostat, so you can't see it. But this is what it looks like. This person is probably wearing a hairnet, not a very good one. He's wearing the gloves. One of the things about liquid argon is you have to keep it incredibly pure. It turned out we weren't able to fill it up by pouring liquid argon into it because that moved too much crud in. What we had to do instead was cool it down with nitrogen or helium and then drift argon in so it would condense into the chamber rather than getting poured into the chamber so it wouldn't bring any crud with it.
Kind of like a distillation thing?
Kind of like a distillation thing. Although, where I'm from, we distill other things. CMS uses crystals. These are beautiful, they're expensive. This is what CMS uses, which is lead tungstate. In this case, particle comes in and it scintillates. It turns some of its energy into light. And we'll cover this in more detail later. This has really outstanding energy resolution because there's nothing in here that doesn't interact with the beam. There's no inert absorber like the lead. Everything here has the energy to go into light. And their plan was to get the best possible energy resolution no matter what it took. Right? So ultimately, their energy resolution was to be about twice what ATLAS is with Higgs was. Also turns out to be very, very low noise. So for ATLAS, this number was 10% over root E. And for this, you see it's 3% over root E. One of the things that's a little interesting is these scintillators, the amount of light they give depends on the temperature. So I'm 50% sure if you heat it up, you get more light, but it could be the other way around. So what CMS did is they got their light sensors to have the exact opposite behavior. So where the crystal became more efficient, the light sensing became less efficient, and vice versa. So they tuned out the temperature dependence by matching them, which I thought was quite clever. So this is a picture of CMS and their calorimeter. It's a little smaller than Atlas's, about half. This radius is about half of what it is in Atlas. And you can almost see the crystals here are all pointing at the origin. So they're tapered. Every one of these is different. This is how all the numbers work out. I should probably point out a story. This is being recorded?
Yeah, but we can turn it off.
I'll tell you the story later. So let's compare the design philosophy. So CMS said, we want energy resolution overall, right? So they went with these lead tungstate crystals. They're expensive. That means you had to make the calorimeter small, and we'll talk about trade-offs later. And there's only a handful of vendors worldwide, and one of the problems is that handful turned into one by the end of the project. And it turns out when you're the last place that can make something, the price may take an excursion. Atlas, on the other hand, emphasized background rejection. Right? And by going to a larger radius, you can separate showers better. So if I have two showers from a Pi Zero right next to each other, and I give it a meter to separate, it'll move a certain distance, but if I give it 2 meters to separate, it'll move twice as far and so on. So to get the back, if you like, if I back off by a factor of two, my energy density goes down by a factor of four. Theorists. And they went to a very highly segmented calorimeter to allow them to measure how the shower develops better. Both calorimeters are very thick. That gives you very good resolution because the showers are contained at CDF. They might be leaking out the back. But it degrades the electron-hadron separation. So sometimes pi zero or pi pluses look like E pluses and pi minuses like E minuses. And we'll discuss this a little bit later. Atlas intended to compensate from that by looking at how the showers develop. So they try to get at that piece of information a different way. So this is what Atlas looks like as a whole. This is, again, our stick figure with his stick helmet.
Why are they wireframe figures?
Yes, because the person who made this put in wireframe figures. Got to be something, right? D0 has dogs. This is the calorimeter in here. Like I said, the whole thing is the size of my house. Maybe a small cottage is the EM calorimeter. The tracker in there is the size of a Volkswagen. So a particle comes in, its momentum is measured in the tracker, and then energies are measured in the calorimeter out here. And out here is the muon spectrometer. Muons are highly penetrating. You kind of got a flavor from that from Francis's talk, that he's able to see muons that have gone through hundreds of meters of ice. Right. Muons interact electromagnetically, but they're heavier than electrons. So when they collide with an electron, the muon keeps right on going, but the electron just kind of fizzles out there. So they can penetrate a large amount of steel. Then we measure where they go in a magnetic spectrometer. CMS stands for compact. And by compact, it's only in comparison to Atlas. These are the people over there. It's still an enormous detector. Yes?
Can you say a bit about how you do muon detection, like how the actual detector works? Just a bit.
Yes, but not today. Actually, not this morning. CMS, their magnet sits here. Their muon detectors are there. They're inside steel. The steel is the return yoke for this magnet. And they have trackers there. And here's their skinny calorimeter and their thicker hadron calorimeter. So they have very different detector technologies. This is an iron core muon spectrometer versus Atlas, which had air. They have a crystal calorimeter versus liquid argon, and they have different emphasis. This was designed to do very good energy resolution at a cost of background rejection. Atlas made the opposite choice. Right. It is important to have two experiments to measure the same thing because one backs the other up. But it's also important that the two experiments use different technologies because if there's a fake bump in one experiment because of one technology choice, the other one won't see it. Right. So that, although the real reason the experiments separated was more sociological than anything else, the different collaborations, when faced with the same problems and two reasonable choices, made different reasonable choices. And that made something which at the end of the day is more powerful than just an 8-pi detector. It's not as, you know, we did better by having two different designs than we would have by making a cookie cutter version and replicating it. All right, I like working at the LHC. You've got all sorts of luminosity. This is good. This is from 2012, which is roughly the search that we're going to be showing. You can see number of inverse femtobarns, and I'll explain where that number comes from. And the number recorded is roughly equal to the number delivered, which is good. It'll never be higher, but you'd like it. You'd like every possible interesting event to be recorded. So the experiments, when they are running, are paranoid about things breaking. Because if something is broken, your data will not exist, or worse, it will be misleading. So you're very paranoid about that. So I like working at the LHC. I miss working at the Tevatron. This event is a zeta 2 muons that has only 11 primary vertices. Only 11. We're now up to typically 78.
What's primary vertices?
Vertex, yes. Watch a movie. Can we see the matrixy? So the vertexes are where the proton-proton collisions occur. This collision gave us the Z. These collisions gave us nothing of any interest at all. To get the number of events that we want up high enough, we have to run in a mode where we have many, many collisions that are producing physics that we are just not interested in. That is the price we pay. The alternative would be to say, well, let's get a single collision. Let's run this number down from 20 back to 1. And instead of discovering the Higgs after running for 1 year, we can discover it after running for only 20 or 30. So if you don't want to do that, the price you pay is what we call pileup.
So what were the vertices?
The vertex is, you see where all these particles are coming from? That's the collision point. It's called a vertex because this particle and that particle and that particle and that particle all intersect at the same point.
What makes a primary
or not primary? So primary, you see, this is a good question. A primary vertex is produced by the proton-proton collision. If a particle is produced in that collision and then decays, it's a secondary vertex. So for example, if you made a K short, it would fly a centimeter and then decay. So, yes?
Is there ever any need to cross-check for tracks that are produced from two different primary vertices that, like, charged particles that scatter off each other or something like that?
So that doesn't happen because, you know, basically the probability of having a collision is 10 to the minus, well, you know, you have to be lined up at the level of a proton.
Right. So it's small enough that you just never
right.
worry about it.
But what we do have to worry about is confusion. Because if I put two of these vertices close together, I might call them one. And if I don't want to do that and I write code to prevent that from happening, it will occasionally split a vertex and call it two. So we try to tune this so that on average, we have the right number, the same number of vertices as we had collisions. But it doesn't mean that we've gotten the assignment right. But you can also see that, you know, it doesn't make a huge difference. So, I mean, this guy's fairly isolated, but if it were sitting even over here, there's only two or three that could possibly be confused with it. All right, so what you want to do is spread things out. By the way, this is, I would say, roughly this long. This was very wise of the organizers to give me an instrument that just happened to match the LHC operating parameters.
Wait, I have a question on that last slide.
Yes.
Why is a Tevatron pileup less than LHC pileup?
Because the Tevatron was a proton-antiproton collider. And antiprotons are damn hard to make.
So the bunches are smaller.
So there's fewer antiprotons in a bunch. And you can have a collision or occasionally two, or maybe even three, but you'll never have this many because you just can't make that many antiprotons. So I worked at Star at RIC, which did gold-gold collisions, and people would say, gold, gold, that gold is expensive. And I would say, gold is not expensive. Antiprotons are expensive. Antiprotons are $500 trillion a pound. And in fact, The LHC, when they run ions, they run lead-lead, and the lead is more expensive than the gold because it's isotopically pure. If you want to run lead-208, you've got to refine, make lead-208. If you want gold-197, you just dig it out of the ground. Gold has one isotope. Just a gee whiz fact. Yes?
How much control of the pileup do you have? Like, can you said how many events happen at the same time?
So we can say, turn us down, but there's a matter of pride, right? The accelerator wants to produce as many collisions as it can as a matter of pride, and the experiments don't want to be the ones to say, turn us down, because it's a matter of pride. So what they are now doing, and we'll discuss a little bit about accelerator physics this afternoon, but they do what's called luminosity leveling. So the statement that we've said is, at the beginning of a fill, we would like the luminosity to be the same as at the end of a fill. So they squeeze down on it more tightly at the end and keep it even. So we deal with one number over the course of the, rather than, you know, having to deal with a factor of two difference. Does that make any sense at all? Two questions. Does that make any sense? And the second is, did that answer your question?
I think so.
Okay. I'm going to call that a win. Anyone else? All right. So we're at step one. We've identified the problem. We need to identify Higgs to gamma-gamma events over three backgrounds. One background is other gamma-gamma events, right? Had nothing to do with the Higgs. Another one is jet gamma events misidentified as gamma-gamma, and this background's 1,000 times larger. And diejet events misidentified, and that's a million times larger. And the calorimeters are the devices that we'll use to do this. Now, QCD predicts these rates. I wrote kinda, sorta, because QCD predicts these rates to maybe 20 or 25%, which is fine if your signal to background is 1 to 1. It's not very helpful if your signal to background is 1 to 1,000, because if I only know 1 to 1,000 at 25%, that's not helpful. So QCD is good in that it lets us know that we're in the right ballpark, we sort of understand what's going on, but we need a better measurement of the background if we want to do a search. And as if that were not hard enough, we're going to do this in the face of a large number of pileup events. The tool we use is something called the ABCD method, which is totally unimaginative. And the trick is, you need two variables that are uncorrelated for the background. Now, I picked this. This actually has nothing to do with the Higgs. It's a monopole search. But the question here is, let's say my signal lives over here in A, and my background, most of it is in D, but I need to know how much of it is leaking into A. All right? And the assumption is, if these are uncorrelated, this ratio, C to D, is the same as this ratio, A to B, and this ratio, A to C, is the same as this ratio, B to D. That's what uncorrelated means.
What is sigma r? What are you plotting on the axis?
It doesn't matter. Variable A and variable B. All I need are two independent variables. All right. And the fact this is spherical or circular is telling me that it's close.
So when you make your fractions, those are null. How much background is in this row?
It's how many events are in each of these. So what I want to do is get background in A. This is the prediction from the measurements of C, B, and D, and that's what it works out to.
Okay.
All right? So what this requires is that your signal lives in one quadrant, because if the signal leaks in any substantial way, you're going to think of it as background and mismeasure it. And it requires, as I said before, these are uncorrelated. So it doesn't tell you how much signal leaks in. Usually you do this with Monte Carlo. But since we're looking for discovery, I don't think I really care if 1% or 2% of my signal leaks into the background. What I'm really worried about is, do I get the background right?
Do you need to have straight line quadrants, or can you have like curvy line boundaries?
If you have curvy line boundaries, these fractions become integrals. What is normally done, if people think this isn't complicated enough, is they put gap regions between those lines. So I have B gap D, and A gap B. And that way, if there's a region where I'm not really sure if it's signal or background, I just ignore it.
Okay.
I can tell you're a theorist. What, a straight line? Please, can we use an integral instead? All right, so for diphotons, here's the case where it matters what the two variables are. This variable is what we call isolation energy, and that is the energy that is not part of the photon but is near the photon. So if it's coming from a jet, chances are there are particles nearby. On this side, it's what I have here is identification cut. It's a complicated thing involving various variables, but basically, if you're down here, it's photon-like, and if it's up here, it's not photon-like. So if you believe the background is correlated, and you can do this for photon number one and photon number two, you know how many events you have in each signal region. All right, so at the end of the day, we do this. We know how many events have zero photons. The events ended up in here, or the inferred background here. Two photons, they ended up here and here. Or one photon where one of them was in the good region, one of them is in the bad region. So now we have to ask ourselves a question. What is it that we're searching for? I know you said the Higgs, damn it. But are we looking for a generic particle that decays to two photons? Or are we looking for the standard model Higgs? And this matters. Because if I'm only looking for a generic particle, am I allowed to use any information I know from theory about Higgs production? No, I'm not. If, on the other hand, I'm specifically looking for a Higgs, I can fold that in. So for example, can I assume that it's spin zero? Spin zero matters because that means the decay is isotropic in any frame. That's a good thing to know. Can we use that? Both experiments made the same decision. They said, we're going to search for the standard model Higgs. Now, for exclusion, this is obviously the right thing to do. If, say, we look for a Higgs that behaved like a Higgs and did not see it. For a search, we decided matching the exclusion strategy was the best thing. We didn't want to explain that, well, the limit, we made this set of assumptions, but if we had a discovery, we'd make a completely different set of assumptions, because that would be hard to explain, and the extra sensitivity isn't worth it. So this is a typical event, much like Francis's typical event. I spent, I would say, two evenings scanning to find an event that was just this typical. In fact, sometimes you just sort of forget to put the space between A and typical. It's a typical event. So this has two photons, one here and one there. A bunch of tracks. You say, well, gee, aren't these tracks pointing at the photon? Well, in 2D they are, but in 3D they're not. So you want to have tracking that looks at all three dimensions. If you look at the calorimeter, these are energy spikes. So you see one from, I get this right. This one is that photon, and that one, that photon. So these energy spikes of the calorimeter say, yes, there's something electromagnetic there. Atlas's calorimeter can look at those showers and say, do they point back to the primary vertex or to some other spot? And in fact, they point within one interaction of the correct vertex. This is about as good as it needs to be. There are also three photon regions because we have a central calorimeter and an end-cap calorimeter, and you can have, and we have this transition region. We'll talk a little bit about design choices tomorrow, but you see there's this big crack here where there's no detector. Why would any sane person design an experiment that had this big crack in there? Yes, you're thinking that, right? You're thinking Tom has lost his marbles, right? Yes. We had no choice because these detectors require power, gas, the signals have to come out. All of these things, which we call services, have to make it somehow from outside the detector to inside the detector, and that means you've got to put some holes somewhere. But it also means that if you have a photon, which kind of is partially here and partially there, it's not really well understood. So we have regions. This calorimeter is the central. This is the end cap. Those are, you know, grade A plus, grade A minus, and stuff in the crack, which is sort of a C minus photon. You know, if you had other reasons to believe you like the event, you might like the photon, but by itself, it's pretty much junk. Oh, before I go, this is what I meant by Atlas having watching the shower develop. So the photon came in here, gave a little energy at this layer, more energy at this layer. You can see most of the energy at this layer and a little bit out the end there. So we can see it develop. This one came in this way, and it didn't make it all the way to the back. So we have a pretty good idea of what's going on. All right, so let's look at some data. All right, this is a plot shown many, many talks, not actually used in the analysis at all. However, you can see a bump at 120 GeV, and the signal in the background here is, I don't know what you want to say, 10 to, no, 1 to 10. It's not great, but it's better than millions. Yes? No? When is the soccer game starting? What do we do instead is we look at these in various categories. This is the way we do the categorization. I first made this plot as a joke to show people how complicated the analysis was, and then I discovered it was being used in talk after talk after talk. So this means I have no sense of humor. But it would start by, are the two other jets in the event? And if so, it moved it into this category. It says it looks like vector votes and fusion production. Otherwise, it would look at the photons and say, did anything convert? Did I have a photon that turned to an E plus E minus pair? If so, I went down this branch. Otherwise, I went down that branch. Are both of them central? You know, they ask geometric questions and so on. And at the end of the day, instead of one plot, there are 10. Yes, ma'am.
What is the decision in the top left-hand corner that has one no and one no response coming out of it? It splits between are there two jets and any convergence?
This thing here? There's no question.
So then why does it say no on the left of are there two
Because jets? This is the question. Are the two jets? No. It goes down this path and then makes a right-hand turn. And it makes a right-hand turn because I'm forced to deal with the geometry of a page.
Yes, I'm sorry. I was starting in the wrong place.
So these are our diphoton backgrounds. And what you can see is these are two real photons, one real photon, no real photons. So our backgrounds are mostly real diphotons from sources we just don't care about. Right? And that's why we stopped improving the photon rejection. We got it as good as it needed to be and stopped. Because all I could get rid of is the green and the red, which tells a slightly different story, but not much different. And it wasn't worth throwing graduate student after making this better because it wouldn't really gain anything. This is at 7 TeV, this is at 8 TeV. The Higgs discovery was done at two different energies. We don't use the absolute QCD predictions anywhere. As you can see, this is the degree that the prediction is. It's not very good, but you can see what we're seeing is not grossly inconsistent with what you would expect from just plain old QCD. So here's the real data in the 10 bins, done in a way that make it completely unintelligible to people, right? But this is the actual data that the search was done on, not what we show. All right, so none of the individual bins are significant by themselves. That you wouldn't expect that to be, because if it was significant in a bin by itself, we'd have shown the plot, you know, a year earlier with everything lumped together. You know there's a theorem that there are no easy experiments? If there was an easy experiment, it would have been done 10 years ago back when it was hard. So there are no easy experiments.
Sorry, the bin corresponds to what?
So this is where it said it's got conversion or doesn't convert, or it's in this geometry or that geometry, or there are extra jets or not.
Right, so, the logical options.
Right, so these
are bins.
End up in category 5 or 6 or 7 and 8. Wrong way. So this is, when I said 7 and 8, these are these guys, for example, right there when you divide it into bins. All right, so nothing's convincing there. So you can think of this as a sort of multivariate analysis, because it is. If you've heard the term boosted decision tree, this is an unboosted decision tree. It just says, let's categorize the events and look at each category separately. So the statistical test we ask is not, is there an excess? But is there an excess distributed in the same way you'd expect a standard model Higgs to be? So a certain fraction in bin 3, a certain fraction in bin 8, and so on. That's the test we're doing. We could have gotten the same total excess distributed in a way that would be very unlikely for the Higgs. That moves the significance down. We say it looks more like a fluctuation. So it's not a pure counting experiment. And the fact that we're looking for a standard model Higgs is built into the analysis. Right? Now, this technique adds a little bit less than one sigma to the search, but every sigma counts. So let's compare two bins here, 9 and 10. And the reason we do this is These bins don't look anything like each other, right? The signal width is just here. You can barely see it in 9 because the signal to background is terrible, but you can see it in 10. Is very different. The signal to noise ratio is hugely different. 9 is almost all background. 10 has a lot of signal in it. The background shape is different. It would have been nice if it had at least the same functional form in every bin, but nature was unkind to us, so it is what it is. The event yield is different. Even the binning has to be different because I have, you know, 160 events here and 30 here with half the binning. So there's a factor of 5 or so in the total yield. So there's no good reason to lump these guys together in an analysis. They just look different. So let's look at this particular event. This event has one central unconverted photon. That's this guy here. And you can see this track isn't really pointing toward it in 3D. And there's not a whole lot near here. This guy has two tracks pointing very close to it. This guy is a high energy electron, and this is a low energy positron, which you see gives it a slightly different shower there. It's relatively low transverse momentum, and this is a category 5. So all of the analyses, all the events have been categorized one way or the other by looking at this and figuring out where it goes. So CMS, again, has a situation similar to ATLAS. It's 3/4 photon-photon, ordinary QCD production, right? And this is why I'm not going to go through the death march of cuts for this, because it doesn't matter, right? At this point, most of what I'm looking at are real photons, and it doesn't matter that their definition of real photon might differ in a few percent from our definition of real photon. Photons is photons is photons. And that's their bump. All right, let me make an observation. So CMS calorimeter emphasized resolution. Resolution was the most important thing. And at the end of the day, their resolution was about the same as ATLAS's. ATLAS, on the other hand, said, what really matters is background rejection. So we're willing to give up on resolution to get great background rejection. And at the end of the day, they got the same signal to background as CMS. So I'm sure there is a lesson in this somewhere. I have no idea what it is. It's time to move on. So July 4th, 2012 is when we made the announcement. We were just over 5 sigma. I was going to buy a hat like that and wear it. And Fabiola told me that if I did that, I would not be welcome at CERN ever again. anyway, both experiments reported seeing a new particle, the same mass, in 2 decay channels. I talked about 2 photons, but they also looked at ZZ star. Turned out they had about the same production rate and same as predicted by the standard model for a Higgs. And with a combined statistical significance of greater than 6 sigma, the P0, the probability that this was a statistical fluctuation is less than 1 in a billion. So you can see the ATLAS measurement here is down to almost 6 sigma by itself. CMS is just under 5 sigma by itself. And when you combine 5 and 6, you get about 6. That's because the probabilities, as you add more standard deviations, are falling so rapidly, there's not a whole lot of difference. Right? The real thing that CMS brought us is, and ATLAS having 2 different experiments, is you can't say, your photon signal was created by your liquid argon or by your crystals or whatever. You had somebody that used a completely different technology and got exactly the same answer. There was some minor supporting evidence. And by supporting, I mean, well, at least not impeaching. So with more data, and data always says we need more data, this is how it evolved. So we're looking at 2 photons. That was the 7 TeV data. 8 TeV was much more luminous. That's why you're seeing it zoom on up. And you can see the bump come out. Want to see that again?
So is the blue line here coming from Monte
Carlo? No, the blue line is actually a fit to the data.
Oh.
It's not coming from a proper fit of the data. What we do, once we knew the answer, we do a fit to the background that excludes from there to there. So it's a bit of a cheat. The alternative, though, is worse. The alternative is you fit a signal shape on top of this, and this has the known feature of suppressing the background so that you can find the bump better, that you get a better chi-squared if you find more particles than you expect in the peak, and you push the background down under that, because the chi-squared is trying to do this bin by bin, and it will add a little bit more, and it only pays the penalty in the top bin by suppressing the two sidebands. You've got one peak and two sidebands. That probably made no sense. All right, here's what it looks like in ZZ. Now, the blue is there to guide your eye. There we go. It's much easier to find the peak when they color it in for you. All right, and you see that, all right, we're seeing events there in ZZ. The background is kind of interesting. Because you're saying, boy, there's a lot of structure in it besides the Higgs. This is Z decay to four leptons, a rare decay. This bump here is where the two Zs become real, both weigh 90. So there's an, you see a lot more events over here. And here in between, coincidentally at a nice low background region, is where the Higgs to four photons comes in.
This is not Monte Carlo.
No, this is data. This,
Monte Carlo. This
is real data as it happened.
No, I mean the red and the purple.
The red and the purple is Monte Carlo.
Okay.
Yes. All right. So, I'm way ahead of time. Way ahead of time. So, first fact. Whatever this particle is, and at these days we said Higgs-like, it couples very strongly to the Z, right? You saw it in ZZ star, right? ZZ star has one off-shell Z, so. How are you going to make that, right? It's a very unlikely thing. So it couples, it's competing with this two photons, which are both on shell. Why? Well, the Higgs, we know, is the Z. That is the third component of the Z, is the Higgs, right? So you expect a huge coupling. So that tells us that Higgs or not, this couples so strongly that you can no longer write down a theory of electroweak symmetry breaking that ignores this particle and have any hope of it being right. At this point, we weren't completely sure it was the Higgs, but it was certainly Higgs-y. And this mystery, which I will talk about in lecture 4, why does it weigh 125 GeV? This makes no sense. At tree level, everything is fine. Well, how many of you are phenomenologists again? At tree level, everything looks fine? Right? Big deal, right? But when you impose the quantum corrections, they push this mass way, 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 way up to basically the level, wherever you set the scale of your problem. So at least at the gut scale, maybe at the Planck scale, unless you impose a symmetry to get it. So for example, in SUSY, you pair each upward correction with a downward correction, so everything is fine. The problem is this mechanism works too well. So in SUSY, this pushes the Higgs mass from wherever it is, below the Z mass. When I was in school, the one thing we were absolutely sure about in supersymmetry is that the Higgs was lighter than the Z. Because it's the mass of the Z times the cosine of an angle. And the cosine of this angle is like 1.2. So this is a problem. And we don't have a good answer to this. So yes, it's interesting that the Higgs came in here, but the story of why the mass is what it is still a little uncertain. I'm not able to tell you that this is a solved problem. This is a confusing mess. I am making way too good time, which means I'm going to blame you and say you're not asking enough questions, but I will try to get a little ahead. If I can... Well, we'll get there.
Okay.
If I can, I'm going to start the afternoon lecture. I'm probably going to go to maybe 15 or 20 after to make sure we have plenty of time. But I need to somehow hit F5 without breaking anything. Oh, like that. All right, so we're going to pretend this is the afternoon. So I want a beam of 7 TeV protons for the LHC. I can stack as many of those as I can together. These are 9-volt batteries. Batteries used to be things that you bought separately and plugged into things. Now, when the battery is dead, you need a new phone. Run out of charge? Buy a new one. So, in principle, this is really easy to do. You put 7 trillion volts of potential on a proton and say, let's let her rip. However, this is not a good idea because this is what 50 kilovolts in air does. And what 1.6 megavolts does, even in acrylic. So deciding that we're going to solve this by building a 7 trillion volt battery may be unwise. So it actually won't work anyway, because even in vacuum, you've got the problem that matter is made out of atoms. And if I try and put this much field on an atom, I'm left with ions. So how do we make an accelerator work? I use RF standing waves. So this is an RF cavity, and let's just go down first. So what happens is I've got the field in one direction, it maximizes, it goes to zero, maximizes in the other direction, and just oscillates back and forth. So that's all that's going on here, and I'm gonna draw just the electric field. So a proton comes in here, and it sees the electric field here, and it's accelerated in this direction. This is much easier to understand than shock acceleration. Really, it really is. So it feels this electric field. The proton keeps moving along. The electric field starts to fall off because it's about to reverse, because this is radio frequency. And then when it hits this tube, it's now sitting in a field-free region, a region shielded from the rest of the electric field, while the electric field reverses. So while the electric field would naturally pull the proton back, I'm now letting the proton hide and coast through this tube. By the time it makes it to the next cavity and is ready to go out again, the electric field is pushing again in this direction. So all of the rightward pushes the proton experiences, and all of the leftward pushes it's hidden from. Yes? No? Easier than shock? Vote here. Who thought shock was easier to understand?
Seems like the reversal of sign is not necessary.
It's not necessary, but it happens, because this is a metal cavity, and I'm putting radio frequency energy into it, and the radio frequency means it oscillates back and forth. So this is a way of getting to 7 trillion electron volts, one electron volt at a time. This is what they look like in real life. This is the Fermilab linear accelerator about to be decommissioned. These are the cavities here. So you see these little things with the holes in them. So the proton moves down that direction. So in principle, our problem is solved. All we need to do is build a long enough linear accelerator, and we're done. If we wanted to do the LHC, that would be 150 miles long and would cost $75 billion. But we know how to do that. It's just a matter of digging enough copper out of the ground.
Is there enough copper?
Yes. There's more than enough copper. So instead, we recycle. We are good environmental citizens. So we have a little linear accelerator here, and we put the whole thing in a magnetic field. The radius of the magnetic field is P over QB. The beam exits here, and it goes all the way around in the magnetic field and returns here. So we give it a little bit of a kick every time it goes here, and then use the magnetic field to drag it back. Right? Now, this is only, well, radius is 4 kilometers, so it's 20 kilometers long rather than 150. It's built out of expensive magnets rather than expensive accelerators. It's probably about a wash. And it ends up being about an order of magnitude cheaper. However, the limit to the energy, I can't go as high as I might like because I've got to get the beam from here to here, and that's a question of, well, basically radius and magnetic field. I can build a magnetic field up to a magnet that'll do 14, 15 Tesla, but not much beyond that. So I've got that limit. And R is limited by how much money I have to dig a tunnel. So those are the factors that go into it. This is a somewhat less cartoonish view. This is the CERN Large Hadron Collider. This is CERN here. The airport is about here. My apartment was there. Cessy, France is over here. Ornay is here. The nearest McDonald's is there. Right. It's a big thing. There are.
McDonald's.
Hmm?
There's a closer McDonald's.
There's one on that side, but
where's the closest grocery store?
There's one right about there. I actually lived, my building was right over the LHC.
So is the rent more expensive inside or outside circles?
The rent is expensive anywhere.
What's cheaper in France?
And it used to be cheaper in France. Anyway, this magnetic field is created by 1,232 dipole magnets, and there's about 10,000 magnets total. We'll talk about the magnets in a bit, all in a ring. One of the tricks is you want to keep the beam from exploding. Protons have positive charge. Positive charge, same charges, attract or repel. Please stop. Yes. I was about to lose all hope for theory. So since left to themselves, think about this in the proton's frame, they all want to push against each other. We have to provide a force in all three directions to keep it constrained. Transverse to the beam, we use quadrupole magnets. So you have a field with north, north, south, south. These are where the lines go. And in one orientation, this beam focuses, and in the other orientation, it defocuses. But there's a theorem from optics, homework. What's the relationship that makes this true? That says if I have a combination of focusing and defocusing, it's net focusing. So the combination of those two gives me a slight focus. Longitudinal to the beam, along the beam, we use the same RF that we used for acceleration. So the beam particles end up in these buckets, and there's a huge potential to get outside of them because the electric fields are now pointing in the wrong direction. So the RF keeps constrains them in one direction, the quadrupoles through what's called a photo lattice, focusing, defocusing, and then focusing, gives us stability in all three directions. So we squeeze along one direction, it squirts out the other, we then pat in that direction, and all the time the longitudinal marches along. Sounds simple. Our next problem is resistance. I put equations that even experimenters can get right over there. If we want the fields that we're talking about, it takes about 12,000 amperes. That's a lot. If you look at the US code, which is probably much less safe than the Canadian code, the wire that you need to carry 12,000 amperes safely is 35 centimeters in diameter. So this big. So it's not so much wire, but shaped piece of copper. And it's probably impossible to control the copper shape accurately. And the resistance is only 0.02 ohms over the entire LHC. But that means that the Joule heating is 3 megawatts.
Couldn't you get it so like, I might be having an idiot moment, but I feel like instead of a single 35 centimeter wire, one could have a bundle of smaller wires, each of them carrying part of the current.
Yes.
That would then overall make up that.
But you need a cross-section of 35 centimeters of copper. So if I add more wire with more insulation, I can only make that bigger. I can't ever make it smaller.
Okay. I just thought it would be easier to manufacture something in smaller pieces rather than trying to get a single.
It probably would be, but because of this 3 megawatts, we're not even going to try.
Okay.
Right. Basically, this would be heating up Lake Geneva at a truly shocking rate.
Okay. That's not short bundle immediately.
So we go to superconducting magnets. This is zero resistance. This is a good thing. Field for these magnets is limited to about 9 Tesla, and they have to be kept very cold, 1.9 Kelvin. And the Carnot efficiency of pumping out any heat that you leak in is 1.9 Kelvin over 300 Kelvin. So, you know, it's less than 1%. So any watt that goes in is going to take you more than 100 watts to pump it back out. So you really want to have these things not just cold, but kept cold. This means you have to have less than 15 watts per magnet. These magnets basically would fit in this room, right? And they can be only 15 watts of power there for superconducting magnets to win. So this is a picture of what they look like. This is a Fermilab magnet. These are the magnets being installed. We do not drop, we lower. And I think I'll get up to the accident and then we'll break for lunch. So superconducting facts. You can break superconducting up in three ways. So you've got the Cooper pairs. Yes, Cooper pairs, yes?
Yes.
Okay. I've seen people nod their heads. So the reason you have superconductors is the two electrons, which are fermions, pair to produce a boson. There's a phonon interaction which binds them. Since they're bosons, they can all occupy the same energy level. And now when I apply a voltage to one with no loss of power, it starts pushing those Cooper pairs forward. Now I can, yes? Does this make some sense? All right. So I can break superconductivity several ways. I can take my Cooper pairs and I can shake them apart, right? That's exceeding the critical temperature. Just thermal motion breaks these. I can pull them apart by either exceeding the maximum current or the maximum magnetic field. Either way, the magnet goes normal. Since we want to run at high fields and high current, that means that we want to go to as cold a magnet as we can. And that's why these things are run at 1.9 Kelvin, even though they could run in principle up to 18 Kelvin. That's where the critical temperature is. But the problem with the critical temperature here is at the critical temperature, you can carry zero current and support zero field. So you need to push this way down here because you want to be living on this curve. So think critical surface instead of critical temperature, and you'll understand how these superconducting magnets have to go. This is what the wire looks like. Niobium and titanium has wonderful superconducting properties. It's got, you know, carries a lot of current, carries a lot of supports a lot of magnetic fields, has very high TC. If you ever hold it, it feels like you've got a handful of Crest toothpaste. It is almost impossible to imagine making a wire out of this stuff. And eventually, they figured out how to make wire. And this is what a strand of cable looks like. This is the cable. You see that there's coppery-looking things and black-looking things. What you do is you put a thin copper jacket around your superconductor. And you have the superconductor in the middle. This gives you the mechanical strength to make wire out of it, which is a good thing. And it also gives the current somewhere to go if the superconducting stops being superconducting. Right? Superconductors make terrible ordinary conductors. And that's not an accident. The phonon interaction that causes the Cooper pairs gives you resistance as well at normal temperatures. So if I have a lot of phonons in my material, it makes a great superconductor but a lousy conductor, and vice versa. So the copper area is 20% of the cable, but since the resistivity when warm is 40 times smaller, basically what happens is all of the current jumps out of the superconductor if it becomes normal and into the copper. So that's what the wire looks like. All right, this is what you should not do with your magnet. All right, so suppose you have a small piece here. This is a cross-section of a wire. Suppose it goes normal there. What's going to happen? It's resistive. So the current, the supercurrent, is going to do what when it sees this resistor? Go around it. So it goes around it. And since at the boundary, I am by definition at my critical current, because that's what makes it a boundary. When I do that, I now drew more current around it. What happens? The spot grows. But that's OK, because the supercurrent knows what to do. It knows to go around that. And so on and so forth. So eventually, the entire cross-section goes normal. And now you have a resistive wire where you used to have a superconducting wire. And now all of the traffic stops it that way. Right? Remember the drive-in on 401 from the airport? Where once traffic stopped, everything backed up. That's exactly what happens here. Only I've got 7 trillion volts on that other end pushing to keep it going. The stored energy in these magnets is 10 gigajoules. That's the same as a 747 at top speed. So you want to let the energy out safely. This is called a quench. What's done here is if you sense that this is about to happen, you fire a bunch of heaters along the entire magnet so it all goes normal at the same time. Instead of having one little tiny spot where you burn it out, you have the whole thing go normal at once. It's still unpleasant, but it's much more recoverable.
I have a naive question. Why does this happen?
Why does it get started?
Yeah.
That's a very good question. Oh, you want an answer? People don't really know. I mean, there are cases. So it is true that if you have a little bit of heat leak, this can happen. But it's not entirely clear why. And there's a phenomenon called training. Well, take a magnet, and it'll start quenching, and I'll let it quench. And after a while, it stops quenching. And nobody really understands the physics behind that. And some magnets remember their training forever, and some magnets forget it right away. So there's a lot of art to this that has not as much science behind it as there should be. I will tell you the fable that was told me. There is no evidence for this, but it is still a good story. And that is, when you have a quench, you have mechanical motion of all the pieces on the inside, and eventually it settles down into a more stable configuration. But we really don't know. It just, sometimes these things just fall over.
So when you quench this, you've still got that enormous voltage across this whole thing.
And you want to take that off as soon as you notice there's an issue.
How do you do this safely?
There are very, very big resistors, often immersed in water, so that the water starts boiling as the energy comes out. Yes, I mean, it's not enough to just disconnect it, by the way, because this is a big inductor. It's an inductor, but yes, you've got a big inductor, and that energy is going to come out. So I will tell you the incident, and, well, do I have lunch and then the incident, or the incident and then lunch? I'll give you the incident.
But before you leave quenching, so what happens to the beam? Do you sweep it out of the way, or does it just bore a hole in the side of it?
What's supposed to happen is the beam is swept out of the way.
That means you turn on the magnetic field and you...
So we have magnets that are called kicker magnets, which have a hole in them in a field-free region, and then we have tungsten wires that we put a lot of voltage on, and it deflects the beam into that hole. That hole then lets you go out, because you have to give the beam time to get away from the magnet, and then goes to a whole different set of optics to a beam dump. At the LHC, that beam dump has a raster scan like an old-style television, because if you put it on the copper the beam dump target, it would just drill a hole right through it. So instead, we slowly sweep it around. And before they put beam in the machine, that's what they test. They test to make sure that the beam dump system is doing what it's supposed to. Right. So right now, we're at 2,558 bunches in the LHC. And they start with one. And when they're sure that one is safe, they'll try 10. And when they're sure 10 safe, they'll try 50. And they work their way up that way.
You said supposed to. Does that mean it doesn't actually happen that way?
It usually happens that way. But
you have a sample that you can...
There have been incidents where we've had quenches in bad places. Generally, what has happened is it's the other way around. You lose control of the beam for some other reason, and now all of your plans on what to do with well-controlled beam when something happens that's wrong go away. And usually, if you have some sort of instability because the beam is doing something that's wrong, it's now going to be depositing energy into your magnets. And eventually, that will lead it to a quench. So I remember at the Tevatron once, these are telling sea stories. You know the difference between a fairy tale and a story a physicist tells? You know, the fairy tale starts out, once upon a time, far, far away. And the story that we tell starts out, no shit, this really happened. So we're sitting there, and the beam debunched. So instead of being sitting in the nice RF bunches, it now was a continuous beam all the way around the ring. It was still focused in X and Y, but not in Z. And we didn't want to just let it go, because it would have quenched every magnet. But things were stable enough that people could think about it. So a lot of phone calls went back and forth. A lot of people thought that would be a good time to start their vacations. And what we decided to do was to scrape the beam away. So to put a little tiny collimator just the edge of the beam, so you'd lose 10 to the minus something of it on every turn, and slowly scrape it off until, you know, so instead of losing it all in a microsecond, you would be losing it over an hour. And that mostly worked. All right, so March 2008, I will let you have lunch now, and we will start off with the accident at 4.
Thank you.